Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. This brilliant today. It's medieval today, and Merin's come back to join me. Merin, who do we have
today? Alex, we have Elisa Yule, who is, I think I'm right in saying, a third year PhD student at Trinity College in Dublin, and she's working on the cultural memory of Breton monasteries and the perception of Ireland in a Breton context from the 8th to the 11th century. Now that's quite mixed and complex in its own right. I know that you enjoy studying trans-regional history and holy men and women in particular too. Mm-hmm. So it's quite complex, and it's something that we haven't really explored in detail before. So can you back us up a bit? When we talk about monks and monasticism in general, a lot of us think of people in brown cowls, low chants in herb gardens and cloisters. And there's an awful lot of cadfael that comes to mind. But that's quite a shallow view. So teach me, educate me, start with some meaty background. What is monasticism? What is it and why does it exist?
All right, so you have the right idea there. Monasticism, at its simplest, is just a religious way of life that requires you to renounce, you know, the worldly in order to devote yourself completely to God, to be one with God. And it's not exclusive to Christianity or the West at all, you know, but in the Christian context, it came from the East, actually. So the word monk comes from monos, which in Greek means like being alone, to be alone. And it's in its beginning form, monasticism was a way of life adopted by anchorites, so people living alone, in the deserts of Syria, Palestine, and Egypt around the end of the 3rd century. And scholars kind of have two theories to explain this phenomenon, you know, the rise of monasticism. If we believe Saint Jerome, who was a Latin historian at the time, he says that these people were Christian refugees who were fleeing persecution under the reign of Decius and Diocletian. But other scholars actually think that once Constantine declared his edict in 313, which allowed Christians to practice freely, these were just people who were just not content with where the Christian community was at. They felt like things had gotten lenient and lax, and I think they just wanted to practice their religion on a deeper kind of level. So
brilliant.
Yeah.
Do you know what, Merin, don't you feel that we've kind of, like, in Britain, we've kind of had this part of our history destroyed? Purposely, like Henry VIII battered it down and got rid of it. So, I mean, like, I going around Poland near Krakow was seeing some religious art and stuff, like carved from wood from the 10th century, and that all got burnt, sold off, melted down as far as we're concerned. So this is really interesting for us.
And so, I tell you what fascinates me straight off is the number of different faith perspectives and geographical influences you've mentioned already. So what is it that decides the actual precise location of a monastery? Is it the people, the ability to find land? Is it a need for faith in that area?
So there's a combination of things. So, you know, in the early kind of period, monasticism, again, was all about the retreat to the desert, the wilderness, you know. So the solitaries got the idea of renunciation from the gospel. You know, the Gospel of Mark talks about John the Baptist crying out in the wilderness, and this is a very vivid image. And, you know, Jesus tells a rich man, and I think the Gospel of Matthew, he's like, you know, if you wish to have a spiritual life, he says, if you would be perfect, go sell your possessions, give it to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven. So it's kind of this idea of isolation, wilderness, etc. So at least the early ones started in places where that was possible. So again, Egypt, Palestine, Syria. First, we see so the eremitical mode of life there, which eremos is the Greek word for desert. So again, you know, that image of the wilderness, you know, a kind of desolate place. And the most influential of these desert hermits was Saint Antony. And the life of Antony tells us that Antony gave up his, you know, inheritance, his parents were landowners, his property, etc. And he actually went into the desert and he placed himself under the guidance of this old holy man. And so we know that he wasn't the first people, that many people were actually going to these isolated places in the desert to practice this way of life. So after his spiritual training under this sort of guru for, I think, a few decades, he retreats even further to a ruin, you know, for 20 years. And once he's done living alone in the middle of nowhere, he kind of becomes a spiritual teacher for the other people in those desert colonies. But then there is sort of a a second kind of way of life. And it was still in the desert, but the second mode of life was the more popular one. It was the cenobitic life, and comes from the Greek word for koinos, which means common. And this is where we get the idea of a monastery. So according to our sources, St. Pachomius was the first one to create a koinobium, which is a monastery, somewhere around the Upper Nile, around 320. So again, still in the wilderness. I think it's worth noting, though, that these monks weren't necessarily, like, miles and miles away from each other. Yeah. These were kind of colonies in a sense. So you couldn't see them, you know, you were out of earshot, out of, you know, eyesight, but yeah. These were colonies. And in the middle, you'd have like a church or a bakery, because at some point all the monks needed to celebrate mass. Right. And another, I guess, aspect of living in the desert was this sort of spiritual battle against the elements and whatnot. So one major kind of aspect of living in the desert was asceticism, you know? And this is, for those of you who don't know, severe self-discipline and self-denial. So these monks would fast, they would deprive themselves of sleep, they would mortify their body in order to conquer themselves. Antony himself, he only ate bread, salt, and water, so a very restrictive diet. But in the desert, it's sort of this arena, again, for a spiritual battle. So Antony, he battles against the devil, who entices him with boredom, with laziness, which is a big no-no for these monks. The devil sends him sort of specters of sexual desire. So women who are like, ooh, please fornicate with us, you know. And at one point, problematically too, the devil sends him a, and I'm just using the phrase that's in the source, a black boy. As which was representative of sexual desire, which is really problematic, but you know, so you know, this was a place where you were constantly harassed by demons. Now, I would understand it as sort of psychological demons. You're in a desert, I'm sure you see visions too, because you're not eating enough, you know, whatnot. So yeah, you have a lot of kind of paintings of these ascetics, in particular of Antony. There's one that I love by Michelangelo, I think, and it shows him being clubbed by a bunch of demons, yeah. Which honestly is how this year has felt so far, so I think we can all relate.
It's almost introspective, and I guess that's part of the purpose of them being a community and renouncing the outside influences that take them away from their affinity with their faith, their saint relationship. But I have a very practical question. You mentioned the bakeries, obviously, for mass, the bread and the wine, and presumably there would have been great content or alcohol content too. But living by bread and salt and water alone is one aspect. How else did they support themselves? I've read stories about them drawing on, villages or other communities from outside, bringing them food. Is that true?
Yeah, that's definitely true. So they actually... made a lot of crafts. So these early monks would weave baskets. That was a huge kind of way to support themselves. They would make linen. They made ropes. And so they didn't have to sell them directly, they would have locals and nearby villages sell it for them, right? So this is one way they kind of supported themselves. But there are other kind of, I guess, instances where they had other people like do the work for them. So for example, we have one extreme form of asceticism. It was Saint Simeon the Stylite, and this was a guy who lived on top of a pillar in Syria for 47 years. So obviously he didn't get down at any point, and you know, he wasn't weaving baskets at the top of there. So people think that he would pull up his food using a bucket and rope, or more likely that he had young boys climb the pillar and give him food. So there was a sort of dependence on the local community in terms of, the basic necessities for life.
So this is the beginnings of it. And then we get to the point in 1536 in our country where the scale of monasticism is so big that it's like literally a threat to the crown, or perceived as a threat to the crown, and taking revenue from them. So how does it, what's the journey to this? Because you research in the middle of that somewhere. So what's the development, and how do monasteries develop into what we see in the medieval period?
Yeah, so eventually theologians in the East agree that the cenobitic lifestyle is the way to go, right? Because, for example, St. Basil Caesarea, he says the community or living in a community is more in line with the social nature of man. And it also fulfills the commandments like love thy neighbor and, you know, charity towards others, which you can't do if you're just living alone in the desert. So this kind of way of life eventually wins. And the monastic movement is kind of spread to the West in the 4th century, first to Italy and southern Gaul, thanks to two factors. So the migration of refugee bishops and ascetics like Athanasius, who wrote the life of Saint Anthony, and in particular the literature of the movement. So, for example, the life of Saint Anthony and other accounts of the Desert Fathers were hugely popular in the West. This is what got the movement going over there. And you know, we see the monastic movement flourishing in the West, but there is already suspicion at this early point. You know, bishops in the West were suspicious of the movement, mainly because many of these monks were outside the direct supervision of the church. It also didn't help that monks were playing a huge role in the theological controversies in the East, and some of these controversies turned violent. And I think the way that it became comfortable for these the bishops and whatnot is that people started writing their own saints' lives, you know. So, for example, Sulpicius Severus, he writes the life of Saint Martin, which is Gaul's first sort of desert monk in a sense, you know. And it not only fueled a fascination with monasticism, but it provided a model that made the church authorities comfortable with this new phenomenon. And then slowly, monasticism was being brought under the institution of the church and the direct supervision of the church to the point where it was getting support from bishops.
So I'm going to pick something up here because, I mean, these are two words that drive me insane. One is historiography, which gets confused with hagiography or hagiography, which is the actual writing of saints, isn't it?
Yes.
So yeah. The writing of saints, are we talking about people who've been canonized, recognized, there's an affinity with them? What is it that effectively makes a person a saint at this point?
Well, you don't necessarily need to be canonized to be venerated as a saint. So none of the saints I study actually are canonized by the church. You know, you have so many local saints that aren't canonized, but, you know, they're still considered saints. So you didn't necessarily have to be canonized, although St. Martin was canonized eventually. You just kind of had to have this kind of notoriety, you know? So a lot of the hagiographies that are written are, you know, written about the founders of monasteries, you know? So, you know, for those who don't know, for those listening, hagiographies are basically the stories of the life and afterlife of saints. And they provided, you know, they were presented as Christian exemplars, and, you know, they were comparable to Jesus and other holy persons, and it features a lot of literary topoi. So a lot of themes are, you know, found in every hagiography. And again, a lot of them are based on St. Martin or St. Anthony. They taught moral lessons, they engendered spiritual reflection, but most of all, they just celebrated the saint. That was the reason why you would write a hagiography. And occasionally to kind of give authority to your monastery if you're like trying to claim certain rights when it comes to land or whatnot.
So the monks you study, how did they live? I'm really interested as well how they got from sort of retrospective in the desert to the really regimented lives they led, like with is it 5 sets of prayers a day and vespers and certain rules about meals and silences, and that is very different to where we're going to go and live in the desert and confront our psychological demons, isn't it?
Yes. So my monks actually, you know, were kind of practicing their religion before we get kind of formal religious orders and rules. So they did practice like the desert fathers, you know, they would pray in icy cold water, you know, remain, you know, with their arms outstretched like Jesus and pray for several hours. It was a pretty hardcore life. But when we get, if we take the Benedictine example, which reaches Europe, you know, in the 6th century, living as a monk was still pretty harsh. It was a highly regulated and disciplined life, as you said. A monastery wasn't supposed to be a place of leisure. In fact, Benedict of Nursia, who wrote the Rule of Saint Benedict, he referred to the community as a scola, which essentially is a military regiment. You know, this is a training ground for spiritual warfare. It was not supposed to be harsh or unbearable, but it was not supposed to be super easy. And so if we take that example, and the Benedictine rule, I have to mention, is not the strictest rule by far. Okay. A monk would be allowed to sleep 8 hours in the winter, 6 in the summer. You were allowed a siesta in the summer. In the winter, you were allowed 1 meal. In the summer, 2. You were not allowed to eat meat unless you were sick. So an average meal included 2 or 3 vegetable dishes with bread and wine. Although Benedict, he says, if you don't have wine in your region, too bad for you. You're not going to drink wine. And then obviously a monk's average day revolved around the liturgy of the hours, or what we call the divine office. And this is just an example. So, you know, around 2 a.m. in the winter or 3 a.m. in the summer, a monk would begin worship with the singing of the matins, which was previously called vigils. And then at 5 a.m. or dawn, you would chant the office of logs. The next hour, around 6 a.m., you would pray the office of prime. And then at 9 a.m., you had terse. And then at noon, you had the office of sext. At 3 p.m., you had the office of nun. At 6, you had the evening prayer, or vespers, as you said. And then finally at 7 p.m., around 7 p.m., you would have the compline, which was the longest service. So you probably wouldn't go to bed for until 9 p.m. And each prayer hour consisted of prayers, some scripture, a hymn, canticle. Again, it varied. So a lot of time was spent just praying and chanting.
So this is like, when they say giving your life to God, they mean it.
Yes, exactly. You barely get any rest. And when they weren't praying, monks were expected to work or to study. So idleness was to be avoided at all costs. In fact, Benedict called idleness the enemy of the soul. So yeah, you could not relax at any point.
This sounds, it's an indoctrinated way of living. And it's a complete contrast, I think, to the way we often perceive monks to be the portly, fat, you know, fellow in the... Because clearly there wasn't that much food. Clearly they had to grow vegetables to live. I mean, they were self-sustaining as far as I understand.
Yes. So
when they weren't praying, they were working. Mm-hmm. Was there anybody else in the monasteries working alongside them, or was it a closed shop?
So early on, you know, monks were encouraged to do the hard labor themselves, and in certain orders as well, they were still encouraged to do that, as you said, grow the vegetables, whatnot. But as the church becomes a bit, or the monasteries become a bit organized, you see monks, they're still performing jobs, but they're not necessarily hard labor. So you would hire sort of lay brothers, people who weren't actually monks, but, you know, were associated with the monastery, to perform, you know, this hard labor, to grow the vegetables, to do the work that you didn't want to do. So when the monasteries become more organized, you know, some typical jobs were, you know, the prior, who was the second in command after the abbot, who was the leader, deans, who were in charge of 10 monks. You'd have the cellarer, who's in charge of provisions. You'd have the monks who took care of novices, so the newbies. You had those in charge of the infirmary, scribes, obviously, to copy and illuminate manuscripts. You had the sacrist, who was in charge of taking care of the books, the lector, the monk in charge of reading, beekeepers, winemakers, etc. But again, I think as time went on, the hard labor went to lay people who were hired.
When does the community aspect come in? Because I'm really interested in, so when the dissolution happened, it sucked like infrastructure out of England, because monks had been providing medical care for people and hospice care. When does that develop so that they're sort of engaging? Is that an offshoot from the people bringing them food at the beginning in the desert, is that grows? How do they develop that role within a community?
I think it was always there. In my research, even though my monks are always striving to be isolated, they do have responsibilities to a community, whether it's to get rid of a dragon that's terrorizing the local village, or, you know, providing some sort of pastoral care, although that was reserved for priests. You do see it from the beginning. So I wouldn't say it came at a certain point. Maybe it, you know, as monasteries became more urban, you know, or were in more urban places, you definitely see that, especially with friars and Beguins, which I'll talk about later, who are living in towns. But I'd say the community aspect was always there.
And were there any, I mean, touchy subject maybe, but were there any women allowed in the monasteries?
No, but it's not that it didn't happen, you know. So women were, they had their own sort of monasteries. You had nunneries, you know. So women were definitely involved, you know, in since the very beginning. You have like desert mothers, I guess you could call them. You
would
know,
they hire like a cook or something that was a female, or would they just not?
It was supposed to be male servants, although you kind of see the reverse in nunneries, where sometimes you would have male servants, and that was a bit problematic too. We see some writers commenting on that. But you do have, so, you know, in the early period, you know, you do have wealthy widows and whatnot who were inspired by the Desert Fathers and who adopted ascetic lifestyles, and they would create these nunneries because they had the money to do so. And at some point, I think in places like Merovingian and Carolingian Francia and early England, you had double monasteries, which was a community that housed nuns and monks separately, but they were still kind of, you know, within the same community. And interestingly, in this early period, you had abbesses who were in charge of both the men and the women in this community. And these abbesses were typically, well, in nunneries at this point, like, pretty much everyone was of royal or noble stock, especially, you know, the women. So you had abbesses who were, you know, probably princesses and whatnot, and they were in charge of the monks as well in these double monasteries. But as you can imagine, there was a lot of clerical disapproval because, you know, women were acting as superior to men. So from the 11th century...
Not like that, would they?
Yeah, oh, you can't have a woman in charge, you know, threatens men, toxic masculinity. So from the 11th century onwards, double monasteries were under the supervision of men.
It makes sense. I mean, in some respects, that the whole maternal, the mother perspective, just it's intrinsically sensible to have a woman sorting stuff out, we all know sometimes. But random question, I suppose, in some way, is there an element of interaction between the two sexes? I mean, do we see any scandal, I don't know if scandal is the right word, but is there any documented interaction?
Yes, well, we definitely have scandal. So, especially because these are sexually frustrated men, I suppose. So I don't have any from my research, but we know because there was a lot of visitations. So you would have a cleric, you know, maybe a bishop or whatnot, who would make visitations to these communities to make sure that everything was, you know, going according to plan. There was no, like, you know, again, scandal. But we do know of clandestine affairs between nuns and brothers. So I know of one in the 12th century, a nun and brother from a Gilbertine monastery in England, or monastic community, were having a sexual affair, and they got found out because she became pregnant. And apparently the nuns, and I quote, wreaked revenge on the lay brother's body, on the monk's body. So I imagine just nuns, like, beating the crap out of this poor monk.
Congratulating him. With...
Yeah, exactly. And
either that or there's some gardening shears and it's a whole other level of revenge.
Well, it's funny you speak of gardening because we have some medieval literature that does talk about, you know, monks and nuns being a bit naughty. So we have the Decameron, which was written by Boccaccio in the 14th century. And it includes a story with horny nuns. So... there's Macedo, one of the main characters. He's a handsome young man and he really needs a job. So he pretends to be deaf and mute in order to get a job as a gardener in the nunnery. And so the nuns think he's deaf and mute, so they decide to use him to explore their sexuality, I'll say.
This was written by a man, right? This is early porn, basically.
Yeah.
This is the equivalent of the plumber coming round to...
That's a great example. Yeah. But all the nuns, you know, take their turns with him, you know? And Masetto knows that he's going along with the whole thing because he's like, oh, I love this female attention. But at one point, the abbess takes him into her room and spends, like, many days with him, if you know what I mean. And the other nuns start complaining that she's monopolizing him.
They're not getting a fair share.
Yeah, so, and eventually the nuns find out that he actually isn't deaf and mute, and they're really mad at him, but they decide to keep him as a steward in the nunnery, so he won't go spilling the beans about their reputation and whatnot. And we have the reverse, too. Obviously, you know, monks were written about a lot, like naughty monks, in the Canterbury Tales by Geoffrey Chaucer, which, again, very late 14th century, there's several stories that kind of criticize the church and members of the church. And in one story called The Shipman's Tale, so it tells the story of a merchant's wife who's in debt because she loves spending money on nice things, on revelry, as he says. And so he asks her husband's friend, who happens to be a monk, which is a bit weird, to give her money to pay her debts. And the monk takes the money from his merchant friend without any of them knowing, and he gives it to the wife on condition that she sleep with him. And Geoffrey Chaucer, the lines written are that for this 100 francs she should all night have hire in his arms bolt upright, so basically that she should be in bed, you know, all night. So yeah, these were very common stories. People poked fun at, you know, monks and nuns, and I mean, they're human beings, and I think people knew that.
So it's interesting that this is being committed to writings. Mm-hmm. If we go back a moment to the hagiographies that you spoke about, the saints and the affinity of saints, one to each monastery, did they swap saints? Did they choose saints? Do we see saints in different countries used for different purposes? How does it work?
Yeah, so the saint of a community would usually be the founder, you know, like the person who founded the actual monastery, however many hundreds of years ago. But you also had, you know, the cult of saints, the spread of saints cults, you know. So you had, I mean, saints could be, you know, the patron saint of a country, of a particular place, of an order, etc. I think when you said swapping saints, it kind of reminds me of when monasteries would steal relics from other monasteries, you know what I mean? So I guess that's a way that monasteries would swap saints and whatnot. So you have a lot of relic theft and monasteries kind of fighting with each other because of that. So yeah, there's a lot of ways that I suppose you could acquire, you know, a saint for your place, and but I think the main way was the spread of the cult of saints, which was done.
Yeah. So you hear a story about a saint somewhere else, and you like the sound of her, so you pick her up.
Exactly. And you know, texts and pilgrimages play a huge role in this. You know, we have a lot of cult images, pilgrim badges that served as like mementos for a pilgrimage to a saint's shrine. And obviously, you know, lay people played a role in that, but also, you know, monks played a role in that as well. As they traveled, they would, they would import new, you know, cults of saints into new places. My monks in particular did that. You know, all of the monasteries in Brittany are destroyed because of the Vikings, so they had to kind of exile themselves. And you see the spread of, you know, the cult of Breton saints go further east into the continent and to England. So that's one way that it was done.
That's really interesting. When I think about Italy, where every day of the year has a nominated saint, and you are born on, I'm Giovanni Battista. I was born on San Giovanni Battista. So the saint, they sort of kind of take with them if they need to. Does the influence of that saint's writings appear in the communities around the monastery in any way, do we know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, saints were for everybody, right? And there's a joke that says that, you know, I love this joke. It says that Catholics need saints because God's too busy dealing with Protestants directly. But it's true. Because, you know, saints are, you know, saints are holy. They're close to God, but they're supposed to act as intercessors between people and God. So lay people, monks, anybody. And although they were technically in heaven, saints were present in the world. So they were present in their locus, so their location, literally where the, you know, their grave was, a relic was, etc. And it was in that place that they would work miracles for the living, petitioning for the spiritual and physical needs of their devotees, which again was anyone in the community. So they could serve as protectors of monastic communities, the ones they founded or whatnot, and just protectors of lay people. And in theory, they had to petition God to intercede on the devotee's behalf. But in practice, at least in the text that I research, the saints are incredibly powerful and autonomous, you know. For example, a kind of typical post-mortem, and I mean like after their death, they're still present, as I said, a post-mortem miracle in a hagiography is kind of a thwarted theft attempt. So a thief or a band of thieves will usually try to rob a church or a monastery, and the saint who is present in that community will stop the thieves by striking them dead, paralyzing them, or punishing them in some sort of way. Like I said, saints could also be the patron of a nation, profession, a place, an act, a cause, etc. So one of my favorite examples is that women would pray and use images of Saint Margaret of Antioch to ensure a safe childbirth, because Margaret of Antioch was swallowed by a dragon and emerged safely using a cross, right? And, you know, both lay and religious people showed devotion to saints. They would both go on pilgrimages to their shrine, which usually contained, again, the body or relic of a saint. They would include them in the litany, which was basically just a chant of a list of saints. They would sing hymns to them, make images of them, again, pilgrim badges. They would write down their vita, you know, their hagiography. And as you mentioned, the biggest way to celebrate a saint was to celebrate their feast day, you know, which there's not one day that's not a saint's day. and I'm talking about them, you know, the ones that weren't canonized as well. And I guess the other kind of aspect of saints was that saints were kind of models to emulate. So people were encouraged to look at the virtues of these saints and copy them, you know. So Mary was an obvious one for women.
They become a framework, an easy narrative against which to build a framework for life. You don't need to understand 74 different statutes if you've got someone you can emulate and the way they lived and what their values were.
Exactly. And saints are super relatable because they were human, you know, or they are human if, you know, they're still holy. And they go through trials and tribulations that we all go through. So I guess they were more relatable in a way. They were kind of spiritual helpers, but also like heroes and role models.
I'd really like to know which one you connect with the most.
Can I do two?
Of course. Yeah.
Okay. So I guess the first saint I resonate with the most is Hildegard von Bingen, which I feel like everyone maybe has heard of. She was an abbess. She was everything. She was a writer, a mystic, a composer, a visionary, philosopher, a sort of scientist, a cookie baker, which I just
spirit animal.
Yeah. And she was, you know, she lived in 12th century Germany, and she had visions from a very young age, and she received the sort of papal approval to write them down and as revelations from the Holy Spirit. And she was just such an incredible woman. She was held in such high regard that she would correspond with popes, abbots, abbesses, princes, emperors, you know, and she was a very strong character. She composed beautiful music, which you can listen to today. I highly recommend, if you ever need to feel like zen and just chill, just listen to Hildegard von Bingen's music. And then another aspect I love about her is that she made up a language, which was called lingua ignota, so unknown language. And she would use this alphabet that she invented to sort of, she would use a secret language, you know, so she was a woman of many gifts. And I'd say my second one, and I am biased, is Gildas the Wise, which we know in Britain, mainly because he just loves to talk crap about, you know, contemporary politicians and kings. So if you love talking crap about British politicians, like, he's the guy for you. And apparently if you, you know, if you believe Breton tradition, he has a grandson named Eul, which is my surname. So I like to believe that we're somehow related, and yeah. So those are my two favorite saints, but yeah, there's so many.
You mentioned relics as well. We did a whole show on that with Emma Wells, because we had a great time talking about nonsense relics from medieval monasteries. Mm-hmm. Have you come across any of those in your research?
You know, I think the early Breton monks weren't really into bodies and whatnot, which is great, because I have to say, like, I'm not really a huge fan of creepy relics, like, you know, incorrupt bodies, or... I came across one, not in my research, but just, you know, it was Christ's foreskin, which was a huge deal. I mean, Catherine of Siena used it as a wedding ring, but that's a whole different story. So I'm not really into the creepy ones.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. I think in my research, it's mainly just bones and whatnot, just normal ones. I haven't come across one that's very strange. Well, I've come across in my research, like, handbells, garments, things like that. They're really, you know, Bretons being, like, Celts, they were really into their handbells and whatnot. And, but my favorite one is actually not from my research. And I feel like it's a lot of people's favorite relic. It's the crown of thorns held in La Sainte-Chapelle in Paris. Mm-hmm. Just because it is such a beautiful building. It was built by St. Louis, and I mean, the stained glass, the ceiling is just absolutely gorgeous, and it's such a sacred space, and it's Jesus's relic, you know, that's the oldest you can get, so I'd say that would be my favorite one.
Just finally, before, I know Meryn's gonna want to know where you find all this stuff out, because she's just nosy like that, but we know what happened to monasticism in Britain, England and Wales, at least. Or I think Wales. Anyway, England, definitely. Henry VIII decided no more one day, and then it was gone. But what happened to it everywhere else? I mean, there must still be monasteries, but obviously it's declined hugely since the medieval period.
Yeah, so monasteries are definitely still a thing. So one of the monasteries that I actually study my research still exists to this day. The only change is that, you know, there was monastic reform, and in my research, at least, some of these monasteries adopted a newer rule, you know, like the Benedictines or whatnot. So it changed the, you know, the sort of way that they practice things. But yeah, monasteries still very much exist to this day. I know in France, definitely, I've visited them. I'm trying to think of where, I mean, they're pretty much everywhere. Like, the, yeah. And yeah, like I said, they're not exclusive to Christianity. You know, you have Buddhist monks, you have, like, monks are still everywhere. Obviously, it's not, as you said, I would imagine it's not as popular today as it was in the Middle Ages. I guess it was just I could see the appeal in becoming a monk, you know, or you were just dumped in a monastery if you're, like, a child oblate, you know, so.
So one of the guys we met in Thailand, he had done his training as a monk and then decided that it wasn't for him. But he recently went back and did a 3-month stint because he felt he's married and he has a child and that, but he thought he needed some time to reflect and some time for some retrospection, introspection. So he went back in for 3 months and stuff. So it definitely does still exist.
Oh, yeah. And I've been to, you know, medieval conferences where some of the speakers are monks, you know. And I definitely see them when I go, not on pilgrimage, but when I go to visit relics and stuff for, you know, educational purposes. So yeah, they very much still exist. I can see the appeal to this day of being a monk, to be honest. Yeah,
definitely after the, well, we've all lived like kind of a monastic life the last year, haven't we?
Exactly.
Definitely the more exposure I have to people in general, the more I can understand the idea of going and living in a monastery.
Yeah, so, I'd want to live in a desert, to be honest, just be away from everyone.
Wadi Rum would be nice in Jordan. That would be
cool. Yeah. We could live there in isolation in a certain amount of peace. Yeah.
My friend Fahid can just bring us like Diet Coke and stuff.
That's perfect. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Dates, maybe. Elise, you've mentioned research several times. Where do you research saints? Where do you research monasticism?
So archives, usually. The texts I work with are hagiographies, as we mentioned earlier, martyrologies, which it's just a list of martyrs or saints organized by their feast day, calendars, churches, just manuscripts, and those are pretty much all found in archives, which are either, you know, in national archives like the Bibliothèque Nationale or in church archives. So ones in Brittany are still housed in the monasteries or in the churches that they're originally in.
What's your favorite document you've like had in your hands?
Well, I haven't been able to go to the archives, unfortunately, because of COVID. I'm hoping that I will be able to at some point. But I'd have to say there's one cartulary. There's a cartulary of Landivinec, which is arguably the most prominent kind of monastery in Brittany, and includes the saints' lives. This is the life of Gwenole, the life of Idunet, who goes to Ireland and just lives in the forest, which I totally relate to. And then the cartulary, which is great to see how, you know, if you're interested in and in how the monks kind of interacted with the lay community, you know, in terms of property and whatnot. And I'd have to say, just from the information that's there, the illuminations, etc., I'd have to say that's my favorite document. And also to think that, you know, this was a monastery that was burned to the ground by Vikings, but this document still survives because they took care of it and they brought it with them. I have to say that's probably my favorite one.
But, and putting that into your hands and being able to literally hold it takes you right back and puts you in contact, doesn't it, with everything you're working on. This has been absolutely fantastic because I don't think I'd understood the impact. I mean, yes, we're quite used to talking about the British, I'm using the word British, but the English aspect of monasticism. Mm-hmm. But it certainly opened my eyes as to the impact and influence of monasticism elsewhere. And I think it's something I might be trawling Amazon for later.
Yeah, she's already buying books.
great. I'm glad I can help in some way.
Thank you so much, Elise. It's been fantastic.
Thank you for having me.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as $1 a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support and here's to your next great book.